If someone stuck a flyer on your windshield, "The end is coming," you probably wouldn't run for cover or run to the nearest copy machine to share the bad news with all your friends. But if someone posts something bogus on the internet, copying and distributing that misinformation is easy. So here we are. Lies, conspiracies, and stuff made up to confirm what the people reading it already believe, all of that gets more eyes and ears than ever before. And in the deluge of all this, how do you tell fact from fiction? And will standards for truth and accuracy seem quaint by the time we elect another president? Three guests, actually four, are here with us to discuss. I bet three of them do most of the talking. We have Precious Yamaguchi. She teaches intercultural communication and new media at Southern Oregon University. Hi, Precious. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, and with Precious is Bodhi Yamaguchi. He's 5 months old and may weigh in from time to time, but we're happy to have him here. We also have Andrew Gay. He's on the faculty of SOU's Communications Department and teaching digital cinema courses here at the university. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
And Mohammed Zamani, you're a student in SOU's Emerging Media and Digital Art program. Thanks for being here, Mohammed.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
So, Precious, let's start with you. Literacy usually means the ability to read and write. Pretty simple.
Right.
But what does media literacy mean to you?
Being able to look at different types of media, including social media. So that would be Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, as well as being able to look at some of the more traditional media, such as television, print media, and being able to decipher what is opinion and what are facts, as well as having a context of how each type of media is used. So if you're using Snapchat, you know that you're only getting a glimpse at something that could be a much larger context than what you're seeing. So it's almost like we get a view into an incident or issue or an event, but to know that we're not seeing the whole event in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Gay, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I agree completely. What I focus on in my media literacy class, I'm sure Precious does this a lot as well, is getting students to understand that media is constructed. It doesn't just appear out of nowhere. It doesn't just grow in a natural environment and we can just trust it as something that's real. Everything that we see in media, whether it's social media or professional media, is constructed. And so I'm trying to get students to recognize that constructedness, analyze it, evaluate it, and also be able to construct their own media in a meaningful way. And that means everything from, being intentional in the way they choose the selfie they post to how do they create their own social media profiles that, of course, employers will see and things like that. So really thinking intentionally about how we construct media and also how we perceive the constructions around us and whether or not they're reliable.
Mm-hmm. And Mohammed Zamani, you're a student at SOU thinking about these things. Where do you get your news and information about the world?
Oh, right. And how do you define news and information and what information is significant or important? So most of my information, I would say, definitely comes from online, but it comes from a diverse number of sources. I mean, I've been looking to stand-up comedy recently for a lot of the information and social commentary. As far as news sources are concerned, I do admit that I typically lean more towards alternative news sources, and a lot of those news sources are shared with me by friends and people who I trust, and usually through social media. Yeah.
And when you say alternative news sources, what do you mean?
As in non-traditional, or what might be called like legacy news sources, so not necessarily CNN, ABC, more of the maybe what people would perceive
public
as being
radio.
Public radio. More of the corporatized news sources, mm-hmm. More of the ones that have been under scrutiny recently. I take information at face value, and I really Precious was saying, so much of it is fractionated, and we're getting these little pieces here and there that we have to kind of construct ourselves in order to understand what's going on. And I look at the discourse that comes out of them, and I'm really concerned about what emerges from all of these little pieces as you put them together.
I love that you mentioned using comedy as part of your sort of news diet.
Yeah, right.
The popularity of satire, maybe like we've never seen it before, like the Daily Show with Trevor Noah or John Oliver's show, Samantha Bee, some of these people who are very keen observers of the news, but they're turning it into satire. However, I want to talk about the difference between satire and the proliferation of what we're seeing now, fake news. And Andrew Gay, what is the difference to you between these two things?
Well, you know, a lot of these fake news writers are still claiming that they're satirists, right? There's an interesting interview in the Washington Post about a major writer who wrote a lot of the fake news that appeared on Facebook. And a lot of that fake news was shared, especially by Trump supporters, as being news that was supportive of their worldview. And yet the writer claims that those pieces were meant to be critical and satirical about Donald Trump. And when you read those stories, and it's really hard to see them as satire, because there's no sort of obvious meaning to them. There's no humor. They're so believable in the way they construct them that there's no sort of clue to a reader that this is intent to point out something that we're criticizing. I mean, you think about The Onion, right? The Onion is hilarious. And a lot of times, you know, there are news pieces that you see in The Onion, or satire pieces that you see in The Onion that are hilarious because they do ring so true, but it's still always pretty clear to at least a fairly educated viewer that this is something that is not literal, right? That this is something that's critiquing something going on in our media environment. And so I think that's a big difference, is that satire, you know, declares itself in some way to be satire. I mean, you know, when Jonathan Swift says, "Let's eat the Irish children," you know, you should be able to tell, like, no, he's not literally saying, "Let's eat the Irish children." And I think that's what's going on in the fake news we're seeing, is that there's no clue whatsoever that we're not supposed to be taking this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on that difference between satire and fake news?
The difference between the two. I do know that reality is under serious scrutiny right now.
Yeah.
And I think that we're trying to define for ourselves what is fake and what is authentic. So looking at those more broad terms and really trying to classify or reclassify things is a big project right now. Yeah.
And we have a lot more to talk about this hour on The Exchange. Our guests, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi, assistant professors at SOU, and Mohamed Zamani, a junior in the emerging media department there. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange after a very short break, and we welcome your phone calls and emails. Would love for you to take part in this discussion. The information for how to get a hold of us is on the way. But first, here's an announcement. @8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange. We are back to our discussion about media literacy. You're welcome to join us. 800-838-3760 is the phone number, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We are talking with Andrew Gay and Mohamed Zamani and Precious Yamaguchi. Precious is an assistant professor at SOU. Also with us is Bodhi Yamaguchi, her 5-month-old son. Precious, we met not too long ago when you were on the program to talk about your recent book, which includes lots of research about how newspapers covered the internment of Japanese Americans without actually reporting on the experiences of these Americans. Do you see parallels today?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the difference is social media, but a lot of it is similar. There's a researcher, Ron Bishop, who works at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and he wrote about how a lot of the big newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle and Los Angeles Times during the time of World War II, they used a lot of reporters as a type of watchdog mentality of looking at Japanese Americans and watching over them as suspicious people. And so I think that we also get that with a lot of different cultures and groups of people that are at risk this post-election. So it's really important to know and look back on history to see that during the time of President Franklin Roosevelt, that was one of the main reasons Japanese people were interned.
Because of the way that they had been written about in newspapers?
Yeah, the way that they had been written about in newspapers without interviews with them, and also humanizing them, and mm-hmm. also defining them as in certain phrases and terms like a sick race or very generalized terms to create fear amongst the public. Uh-huh. So I think that when we look back in history, I always like to what Walida Imarisha, a researcher, once said, that we don't see history repeating itself exactly, but we look at it as a spiral. When we look up into history, we see things that are similar that kind of spiral down throughout history. Mm-hmm.
So what things do you see that are similar today?
I think that the fear of people of different ethnicities and different religions is something that we see. I think that our country is made so much of immigration, and we see the fear of the different groups that are coming in. And so lots of topics of people who are of different ethnicities that actually, like Japanese Americans, very well much could be citizens and have been here for a long time throughout the different generations. So I see that same fear that happened during World War II happening now.
Yeah, anyone else want to weigh in on this idea of history, the cycles of history? And also I see that as propaganda, I mean, in many ways. And how does propaganda... What does that word mean? We were just talking about what fake news is. What does that word mean today? And how does it manifest today and in what media outlets? Mm.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the history of the news, and even Precious citing how Japanese Americans were being represented in the news. And I know, even looking at the history of the news, it's interesting to kind of think about what role the news actually plays as far as the dissemination of information is concerned, because propaganda itself is just yet another form of information. So it's I'm not so sure if we're seeing a recurrence or a resurfacing of these things, or if these things have just been kind of maintained and have been sort of hidden. As far as propaganda itself, I mean, that's I guess that's part of what we're talking about today with the fake news phenomenon. And
do you see fake news as a form of propaganda?
Well, I guess we would have to define. I mean, I'm assuming that we're talking about propaganda as a source of false information, or something that is not necessarily based in fact and more based in sentiment. Or I guess that's what we could discuss.
Yeah, let's ask Andrew.
But I think what's interesting here is we don't even necessarily have to go all the way to propaganda to be concerned. We talk about media literacy, the theory of agenda setting, right? That all media. Even, our trusted news sources have a role in setting the agenda for the public discourse, right? Mm-hmm. And that by the prominence of certain news stories, by how they're framed, all those kinds of factors, that's how the public decides what's important mm-hmm. and what they should be paying attention to. So, for instance, Andrew Tindall, who runs a website called The Tindall Report, basically, it's just a guy who watches the evening news every night. He watches ABC, CBS, and NBC, and draws data from what he sees there. And in 2016, the evening news broadcast spent 100 minutes on Hillary Clinton's emails and 32 minutes on all other policy issues combined. And those 32 minutes included no policy on trade, healthcare, climate change, drug policy, poverty, gun policy, infrastructure, or budget deficits. And so that's what the evening news is sort of telling the electorate, right? This is what's important. This is what you need to be paying attention to. And that has a shaping factor. Now, what's interesting is with social media is we now have a different method of agenda setting, and we have a president-elect who's very savvy with Twitter. Mm. And there's a lot of debate right now about the things that Donald Trump tweets and what role they're playing in setting the agenda of what the media is covering.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting you point out, do you think that I have personally encountered a really deep sort of resentment of what you're calling legacy news and and people, almost a conspiratorial mindset that people have about what the agenda is of historically very trusted news sources populated by professional journalists. But then you have 100 minutes spent on emails and 38 minutes spent on all other policies combined. Is that driving people to social media where it's even more of a jungle in terms of what's real and what's made up?
I think it is. I think, you know, it's interesting. 44%, according to Pew Research, 44% of Americans get their news from social media. And I know I'm one of them. I primarily get my news from social media. I use Twitter especially, and I follow, you know, what I do is I make sure I'm following a lot of different kinds of news sources. So some of the sort of alternative, independent news media, public news media, and corporate news media that is perceived to have sort of different biases. So, you know, I'm following Fox News and MSNBC and all the sort of reporters who are working for both. But most people aren't really doing that, right? They go and social media, and they find that voice that they feel is trustworthy. And so there's an interesting Scientific American article was just out asking, what is the impact of that social media bubble? And is it that people aren't encountering news sources that contradict their opinion? And it's not so much that they aren't encountering it, because they still are seeing other opinions. They just reject them. They say, I don't believe that. I don't trust that. So that's kind of a challenge, is that even when news media is doing a good job giving information, fact checking, if the electorate is going to just reject opinions or not opinions but facts that contradict their opinion, I don't know where we go from there.
Yeah, there's a clash of realities, definitely, that's occurring. And it's interesting you bring up the discourse, and we were talking about propaganda. And I guess maybe in that context, looking at propaganda as a way of trying to control discourse or leading discourse towards into a certain arena. But yeah, it is interesting that with social media, you know, like in the past, you would watch the news or read the newspaper, and then you know, there was so-called water cooler talk or what have you that you would engage in the next day or what have you. But now the discourse is so much more immediate, and I think that that's what people are looking for on social media, that you can react immediately to to the information that you're getting, and you can compare those reactions to the immediate reactions and responses of other people. And that's, you know, whenever I read an article, I don't just read the article, I read the comments section too. That's part of the news source to be, you know, is seeing
you're a brave man.
it's seeing how people are reacting to it, what comments are going on there. I seldom participate because it usually turns ugly, and that's just showing me that there is no consensus reality, that there is a big fractionation going on, and that and this is something that's being looked at. I just read an article from The Atlantic or Atlantic.com yesterday, a cognitive psychologist basically saying that his studies are showing that there is no such thing as a consensus reality, and the title of the article was The Case Against Reality. So it's really interesting to see how the different realities, the very individual and personal realities that are coming out, and how that's what people are heading more towards. It's more about having those reactions and having those responses and forming this very individual, bubbleistic reality around yourself, you know, yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Mohammed Zamani. He's a junior at SOU's Emerging Media and Digital Arts program. Also in the studio, Andrew Gay, an assistant professor of digital cinema, and Precious Yamaguchi and her son Bodhi Yamaguchi have stepped out just for a second. I hope they'll be right back. I want to push back just a little bit there, Mohammed, on that idea that there is no reality. I mean, are facts not still stubborn things? Are they?
Right.
Facts are real. I have to believe that.
Well, it depends on who you ask. a recent poll showed, this is from Rasmussen Reports, which is generally considered actually to be a slightly right-leaning pollster. A recent poll from Rasmussen Reports showed that 90% of Trump supporters reject fact-checkers. They do not believe them. So if a fact-checker like PolitiFact or, you know, the Washington Post fact-checker says that something is, you know, four Pinocchios or a pants on fire, they reject that. They say, no, that you are not a trustworthy source. And so, you know, yes, facts are things. But, you know, I think this actually comes not from the fake news. I think it does come from sort of a dangerous environment that the sort of so-called legacy news media has created, in which all topics and, you know, the past decade or more tend to be covered in this sort of he says, she says manner, right? Politician A says that Mexicans are rapists. Politician B rejected that claim and said it's not true. And that's how news stories often get covered. Instead of saying, you know, politician A falsely claims this, and here's the data that shows it's false, we see a lot of news articles, a lot of cable news stories covered with, you know, two representatives giving two views. And the audience is left with this perspective of, oh, this is an unsettled manner. It's up to me to decide what I believe. And I think that's dangerous.
Mm. How do you get your facts? We want to hear from you during this discussion. What is your social media feed like? How do you weed through things that are patently false, things that might be true? What do you do when something seems outlandish? Bring your stories to us here at The Exchange, 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. We're having this discussion in 2016 when the word of the year from Oxford Dictionary is post-truth, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion or personal belief. Word of the year, depressing as it may be, let's try to go somewhere positive with this. Mohammed Zamani, your student at SOU, when you see something on Facebook or Twitter or in any media outlet that seems outlandish, how do you approach that? What are some good ways that you use to recognize bias, spin, misinformation, or just flat lies?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I question everything. I mean, it is, but it is kind of, I mean, as much as we like to talk about progress, whatever that means, part of progressing or progression is definitely not. I mean, you were saying that, you know, I need to believe that facts are real, but I don't know how much we can allow the facts of today to remain stagnant or to believe that they're going to be the facts of tomorrow. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm heading into more philosophical territory here, but you know, it's important, I think, to continue to question what you consider to be real and what you consider to be factual, because a lot of that, in order to continue to develop your thoughts and develop more and more layers of understanding and comprehension of the world and continue to progress discourse and et cetera, I think it's important to continue to question everything that you take in as being true. So that might sound like a tall order or what have you, but yeah, factual representation. I know that's what, when we talk about real news, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about objective truth presented to us, like Andrew said, that we can then decide how to respond to.
Or you've gone to lengths to have the correct number and
statistics,
origins,
right,
of sources, mm-hmm, so that you can lay out something that you – journalists are not arbiters of absolute truth. They're arbiters of fairness and accuracy. And right. I think that somehow that gets lost in this discussion. Andrew Gay – is Google enough these days? If you say something that's like, oh, professional protesters being bussed in, and it's in one source, one guy's Twitter feed, in the age of things going viral in hours, you can Google something, and even if it's false, it'll have like 10 hits.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and that's right. You know, that's what used to be my default. If I saw something, I would, you know, first let's Google it and see if it's true, and you can find all these hits. You know, first of all, I think that one of the things I tell my students is when you're thinking about what you share on social media, whether that's news or fake news, you know, what we tend to share is things that we agree with, right? It's very rare that I'm going to suddenly share something that changed my mind. I don't share the fake news piece that suddenly, made the politician I love seem like a terrible person, right? I'm going to be sharing the piece that confirms all of my biases and feelings, right? And so I just teach my students to whether you think it's fake or real, question that. If you get a piece of information that immediately sort of feels so good and confirms what you want to believe about a person,
like
question that.
Refined sugar news.
Right. I mean, because, you know, even, you know, we can even talk about real news with that, right? You know, where, you know, something gets reported about, you know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump and, you know, it's an early report and everybody shares it. And then later some more context comes out and it's like, oh, well, maybe it wasn't quite as bad as what they said. that. But of course, that clarification doesn't get the widespread sharing. So I always tell them to sort of like, you know, ask, are you adding value to people's lives and what right. you share? So if does this piece give new insight? Does it give in-depth reporting? Or is it just this the snappy sort of clickbait headline mm-hmm. that confirms what you want to believe? You know, and then from there, you know, you can check, obviously, check sources like factcheck.org, like PolitiFact, like Snopes is a good one. And these are pretty, you know, Snopes is fairly on it. It's interesting that, you know, there are pieces that get shared and I'll check and within 5 minutes, it's already been debunked on Snopes. So I do encourage students to try to do that, but it's harder. It is harder than it used to be.
Mm. Let's go to the phones here. We've got some listeners who are choosing to participate. Let's go to Jake in Eureka. Hi, Jake. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, I'm calling with my concerns about the Russian government having spread these fake news stories on Facebook. According to the intelligence community, the latest story a few days ago, that they were able to trace most of these fake news stories back to Russian government sources. Considering the fact that Vladimir Putin is an adversary of the United States, aren't we at least a bit concerned that the Russian government was directly involved in our election results?
Mm. All right, Jake, thank you for that. Anyone want to take a swing?
What do you know about Russia, Andrew?
You know, it is concerning. I think that it is interesting that we are not seeing more of a discussion about, you know, the role of that Russia may or may not have played in our election, at least in terms of shaping perceptions. There's fairly good evidence that Russia had an influence on the perceptions of how the election went, how people perceive the candidates. There's also, you know, a lot of debate as to whether or not, you know, they have had any sort of hacking or anything like that. And there's little evidence to show that they actually impacted the election results itself. But, you know, there's always been influencers, right? There's always going to be people who are trying to shape,
like an entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley,
right?
Making
right.
$30,000 a month,
exactly. Right. And so for me, I mean, yes, it's alarming, and it's something that we should be talking about. At the same time, I'm not. It doesn't really matter that much to me where misinformation is coming from. If it's Russia, and you know what, you know, if I'm Putin, yeah, of course I'm going to want to be influencing other elections. We do it too, right? United States.
Follow sources of misinformation? Do you like keep misinformation in your news diet? If you know,
oh, that's an interesting question. Mm. You know, honestly, no. Most of the time when I've identified something as misinformation, I try to sort of filter it out. Right. That's an interesting strategy to think about. Like, okay, well, now I'm going to follow this so I know what misinformation is.
I mean, as a talk show producer, yeah, I definitely do.
Yeah,
that.
That's interesting.
Let's go to another call here. We've got Dennis and Eugene on the line. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. So are you guys up for a little criticism?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay, here's one of my – first of all, I don't use – any social media for news.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the news I get, I read. Also, the criticism I wanted to make is that, especially on television news and cable news, they use a lot of stereotypes. Like, if there's a tornado, they go to a trailer park. Mm-hmm. If they want to show black crime, they go to the worst place in Chicago or L.A., and they show some young black guys, and that's who you think is crime. If they want to talk about the Muslims, why, they find a lady with a burqa on and a guy with a big hairy face. So, you know, the media perpetuates all these terrible stereotypes over and over again. I can turn on television right now and see them everywhere. And until TV, which most people watch and get their information from, quits doing that, it's never going to go away. And the other thing that I really hate about the news media is they always bring on two people, one who's the far right and one who's the far left, and then they have them argue about something that a politician said, when they should have the actual politician on, and then people should believe what the politician tells them.
Hmm. All right, Dennis, thank you for those comments. I mean, I think you raise an interesting idea there of false equivalence. Mm-hmm. When we have, say, someone who says climate change isn't real getting equal time with 99.5% of the world's scientific community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what kind of I was referring to a moment ago in the sense that I think that the media has created this sort of everything has two sides. And it comes out of a sincere place, right? Real journalists want to present objectivity. They don't want to appear biased. So with that, it has come, you know, how that, you know, comes out is that, you know, for every climate change story, you're right, what we usually have is, you know, oh, we're going to bring on what is typically a right-wing policy wonk and Bill Nye, who is not a climate scientist either. And instead, we don't...
But they're both camera ready.
Right, they're both camera ready. And that's how we learn about climate science, right? But, you know, he brought up some really good points there. One is that, and that goes to what I tell my students, that all media is constructed, and it's constructed using creative languages and persuasive techniques, right? And so, yeah, news producers are serving, most of them, right, corporate shareholders, and they're trying for ratings. So, of course, they're putting production values. And then we can talk about print media because that's so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is so much to talk about here. We've just scratched the surface, and it is a brave new world out there, folks, and something of a jungle if you're looking for news on the internet or even in traditional media landscapes. I want to thank our guest, Andrew Gay, for getting the conversation started. Andrew's an assistant professor of digital cinema at SOU. Thanks, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
And also with us, Mohammed Zamani, a junior at SOU's Emerging Media and Digital Arts program. Thanks, Mohammed.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Precious Yamaguchi for being with us with her son, Bodhi Yamaguchi, for the first part of the hour.